Good morning. The court calls LRM v. Katzenberg. Just so everybody is on the same page here, our order of presentation will be the appellant, LRM, the appellee, Katzenberg, then the real party in interest, and the United States. I'm sorry, I'm looking the wrong way. And then the appellant will have the opportunity for rebuttal. Does everybody think that's what we're going to do? Okay. That's how we're going to proceed then. And I understand, so appellant, LRM, Colonel Thurl. And you've reserved 2 minutes for rebuttal, I see.
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay.
May it please the court, Chief Judge Baker, honorable judges. I'm Colonel Ken Thurl, along with Major Matt Talcott. I have the privilege of representing Erwin LRM, the named victim in a sexual assault case in the trial of Airman Daniels. Now, the trial below is United States versus Airman Daniels. In that case, LRM is not a party. She's not the prosecutor, but she's also not a stranger to the court. In fact, as to hearings regarding whether it appears her privilege and to reveal her personal information, her private information, her sexual history, she is, in fact, the real party in interest. This case is remarkable for one reason. After reviewing scores of cases and reading hundreds of pages of briefings from the real party and the appellee and the amicus, we have not found a single case holding or ever endorsing a judge's determination that an individual who has demonstrated standing, that his injury, causation, and redressability ever being denied the opportunity to provide legal support for their position through
counsel.
Your Honor.
What is the interest that is vindicated in a federal criminal trial, whether by court-martial or in U.S. District Court?
Your Honor, the Airman LRM, like numerous non-parties to court-martial, brings interests that are adjudicated in court.
What is the interest that is at stake? Is it not the interest of the state?
Your Honor, in fact, it is her privacy interest. The 412 and 513.
Counsel, he's not asking you about the interest that you're alleging. He's asking what is the interest vindicated by a criminal prosecution. That's the question that you're being asked.
Thank you, Your Honor. The interest of the United States is to seek a prosecution, is to seek justice. The interest of LRN in this matter.
Okay, you answered my question. It is the interest of the state, in this case, the United States, in seeking justice, in seeking a just result. Is it not?
That is correct, Your Honor.
Okay, it is the interest of trial counsel, the interest of the state is not the interest necessarily of any other person. Correct?
That is correct, Your Honor. Okay. Now, in fact, in this case, I think it's important to note that the interests of Airman LRM are distinct and different from the interest of the trial counsel.
That may well be true, but that doesn't answer the fundamental questions of whether we have jurisdiction and whether she has standing.
Your Honor, both jurisdiction and standing are paramount in this case.
Right. Why don't you summarize quickly, or succinctly, I should say, not quickly, how you distinguish or address CCR?
Your Honor, CCR is different in three fundamental ways. The first is, in CCR, we were talking about an application of a rule of court-martial. It was essentially the disclosure of information to essentially a non-party, and in fact, a stranger to the court. This is the adjudication, is the procedure for ruling on a rule of evidence. Now, evidence, by its very nature, must have the ability and the potential to impact findings or sentence. So that's the number one difference. This clearly goes to findings or sentence. And it's because advocacy matters. Military judges are able to arrive at the correct result by allowing advocacy from the various people with interest. I would point out that in a judicial...
I thought that your position below at trial was that you didn't have any interest in advocacy, that you didn't intend to advocate. But yet, in your briefs, you seem to be suggesting that you, in fact, have the same rights that an intervener in a civil case would have.
That's, Your Honor, there's a difference between advocating for the admission or non-admission of evidence and nothing advocating for her right to privacy. What we want to ensure is that the military judge properly weighs her interest as well, as he's required to.
Well, what if the government had chosen not to bring a case at all? Is it your position that as a victim, that LRM would have a right to appeal that to this court? Because it seems to me that the necessary logic of your position would yield that result.
That's not correct, Your Honor. Linda R.S. essentially says that a victim of a crime doesn't have an interest in the prosecution.
No, I understand that, but I'm having a hard time understanding is how to distinguish that from your argument here, which is different than the argument that you made at trial.
Your Honor, I think there's a large body of case law out there where limited participants have been able to go into court and protect their individual interest. For example, and it's been often at the trial level.
Are you arguing this case beyond 412?
Certainly, Your Honor. The Carlson Ryan Jones is the perfect example where 412 essentially was the issue. It was for the privacy interest of the petitioner.
In that case, the petitioner was alleging that the military judge had gotten something wrong, right? I mean, nothing has happened here. Your injury that you are alleging is entirely speculative at this point. There's been no ruling by the military judge on any 412 matters or any raised, as far as I know.
Your Honor, in fact, what he did and what makes this case right is he denied her standing. In other words, because the interest of the government and the victim
But she needs to have injury in order to have standing.
The injury is the denial. In fact, it's essentially a procedural due process issue. She's been denied the ability to articulate.
How is that injury in fact? Leaving aside the question of whether standing or whether the criteria for standing, which is a common law doctrine basically made for civil litigation, even apply here, but leaving that aside for the moment, how does she have injury in fact, as standing is usually understood, simply by what has happened so far?
Your Honor, by being, essentially what happened here is the door was shut to the courtroom. She will never be able to present her legal interest. She will never be able to present to the military judge her views on privacy.
That assumes she has a cognizable legal interest.
That's correct, Your Honor.
Okay, where does that come from?
It comes from three sources. The one is the Constitution says that privacy is, in fact, a liberty interest. In Whaling v. Roe, it talks about the right to privacy as a liberty interest. That's one source. Second source are the rules of evidence. Both MRE 412 and 513, very specifically, were designed to protect the privacy interest of the victim. That's the sole purpose. It's interesting that these are one of the only two rules that actually require a hearing. And that hearing is required regardless of who the proponent is, whether the government is a proponent of the evidence, whether the defense is a proponent, even if both parties agree that the evidence should come in, there's still a requirement for a hearing because it's her interest that are at stake.
Can I ask you to go back on the distinguishing CCR? You said you had three arguments. I want to make sure you were able to say all three. Your first and primary was that evidence by nature impacts findings and sentence. Did you have two other arguments?
I do, Your Honor. The second one is in that particular case, the accused was indifferent to the result. In this particular case, at the trial level, the accused opposed Airman LRM. Therefore, this case could get to either the Air Force Court or this court to Article 66 or 67. What I'm saying is subject matter jurisdiction, as opposed to standing, isn't dependent on how the military judge rules on a particular issue. So this case would have gotten here had, for example, the accused challenged her ability. And in fact, she had been granted the opportunity to be heard.
What was your third argument? You got to get them out when you have the chance.
Yes, Your Honor. The third one is, in fact, that this is not a collateral civil issue. This is something fundamental to the jurisdiction of the court, which is the rule of evidence.
Counsel, within the context of the three certified issues, which obviously you had nothing to do with, what would you have this court do specifically?
Specifically, number one, it is fine that they have jurisdiction because it goes to subject matter. Second, as defined as standing, because he's articulated an interest, there is causation, which is the release or non-release of her records and his redressability, the judge can grant her the relief. And we would have this court issue a writ of mandamus ordering the military judge to grant her the opportunity to be heard, much as court did in Carlson.
How can this court issue a writ when there is no petition for a writ in front of us? The CCA did not rule on the substance of a writ, nor did the trial court.
Your Honor, this court has, in fact, the power to issue a writ, and there's no requirement for it to go back through back to the Air Force Court.
Tell me again why this is ripe, how this is ripe for decision.
Your Honor, it's ripe because when she notified the judge that she wanted the opportunity to be heard, and you'll note at the trial level, there was even a motion for reconsideration that made it abundantly clear what she was asked for. She was denied any relief in total. In fact, the door was shut. She cannot go back, and she will never be given the opportunity to be heard, no matter what occurs.
Counsel, is there 412 evidence that the government has proposed to admit into evidence?
In this case, it's the defense that's proposing to admit the evidence.
Okay, and was your client notified of a hearing?
She was, in fact, notified of the hearing.
And was your client given the opportunity to consult with government counsel about the hearing?
Yes, Your Honor.
Has the hearing taken place?
It has not, Your Honor.
And the military judge did make clear that both you and your client would be able to attend the 412 hearing, correct?
Your Honor, he further said that she would be unable.
Can you just answer my question?
Pardon me, Your Honor?
Can you just answer my question?
Yes, Your Honor.
And he made it clear that she would be able to speak at the 412 hearing, right?
She would not be permitted to make a legal argument, Your Honor. She would be permitted to speak.
I don't think he said that she couldn't make legal arguments. I think he said that you wouldn't be permitted to make arguments.
Your Honor, in fact, what he said was that she had no standing, which he equates with making a legal argument. And that, in fact, if anybody could be heard to make a legal argument, it would be the trial counsel.
How is there standing here in the absence of a statute or a rule conferring it?
Your Honor, standing can come from a number of sources. It can come from the Constitution. It can come from statute. It can come from common law. And we would assert it comes from all three in this case.
Remember that since 1812, there ain't no common law of crime in the United States. And a fortiori in this system, their statutes are nothing.
Your Honor, she is given the rules of evidence, she's given a privilege. That's a legal interest. For example, subpoenas.
The rule speaks to her being heard and nothing more.
Your Honor, being heard means something. It's a term of art. And the fact is that, as the Supreme Court said in Pelham v. Alabama, if you bring an attorney in with you to a court, it's essentially a denial of due process to not allow.
I'd say Powell is hardly analogous to this case.
Counsel, could you address on rebuttal whether you have uncovered any federal case in which a federal court has held that a victim's right to be heard extends beyond the ability to speak in person, as opposed to being confined to merely submitting written submissions, and furthermore, whether there's one that addresses the particular right that you're alleging that she has in the context of pretrial motions or the case in chief itself, as opposed to sentencing matters.
Your Honor, I'm out of time. I can handle that rebuttal right now.
On rebuttal would be fine because you're out of time.
Are there additional questions?
I've got it.
You're on the court's time now.
A couple of quick questions. At trial, counsel for LRM advised the military judge that they sought to assert the rights as a victim of crime under federal law and under rules 412 and 513 and 514. At the Court of Criminal Appeals, the court characterized it as an opportunity to be heard through counsel at hearings under 412 and 513. My question is the issue before this court anything beyond the right to be heard through counsel under 412 and 513?
Yes, Your Honor. I believe the right to be heard emanates from the fact that she has standing that comes from all three sources.
I understand that. But in terms of the focus of what that standing might be from whatever other source, does it extend beyond a hearing under 412 and 513?
We are requesting nothing further than 412 and 513, Your Honor.
Are you, is the counsel in this case in any position different from counsel who might be hired as a private counsel by a witness in any case in a court-martial and wish to make an appearance on an issue of privilege, for example, under Rule 513?
No, Your Honor. She should be treated precisely the same as civilian witnesses have.
And are you seeking to have anything adjudicated about the Special Victims Counsel program at all, or are you seeking solely to have this case adjudicated about the right of any witness who is subject to a 513 or a 412 motion to have counsel represent them in that proceeding?
Your Honor, this case is not about the Special Victim Counsel. Any rights she has existed before the program but will exist long after the program.
Thank you.
Assuming jurisdiction and standing for the purpose of this question, could you return to the reasonable opportunity to be heard? In your view, is the judge to apply sort of an abuse of discretion standard and factor in what is reasonable under the circumstances presented?
Your Honor, this court in the Carlson decision essentially said what, and in fact that court case has also been adopted as the proper procedure for 412 later on the Sanchez case. That's the process, what this court said, which is the opportunity to present evidence and make arguments.
And in theory then, within the judge's discretion, that could be done in writing or orally or both?
Your Honor, it could be done in writing. In this particular case, he was denied whole hog. I mean, there was no relief. He was absolutely denied standing.
But you're not here to argue that it would be an abuse of discretion per se if that argument occurred in writing?
No, Your Honor, we're not stating that. He was it was a blanket carte blanche denial of any ability to appear.
And therein, in your view, is the abuse of discretion, were it to get to that?
Yes, Your Honor.
Would you be arguing for a right of appeal as well, or would this be limited to the contours of 412?
Your Honor, LRM has no right of appeal, per se. I mean, the only right she would have is through writ mandamus for this particular issue. In other words, there's no way, at least currently, that we believe that she certainly didn't have an Article 16.
Could she refuse to testify, be held in contempt, and challenge the matter in that fashion?
Perhaps then there would be an issue. But I was going to say, in other words, she's just dissatisfied with the ruling in 412 or 513. We don't believe she has a right of appeal.
Are there other questions up on the bench? That was on our clock, not on yours. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Your Honor.
We'll now hear from the appellee, Kassenberg. Thank you.
Chief Judge Baker, honorable members of the court, may it please the court. I am Major Ryan Kovac. By order of this court, the Judge Advocate General of the Air Force appointed me to represent the appellee military judge. As in the Center for Constitutional Rights versus the United States, this honorable court should exercise jurisdictional judicial restraint and affirm the Air Force Court's order finding no jurisdiction to hear a non-party's writ petition.
Counsel, so I understand your position in this case. Are you representing the military judge in a personal or official capacity, or are you here representing the decision of the military judge in which the military judge has no interest one way or another?
Your Honor, I am representing the judge's position and his order, his rulings in that regard, and I believe that's the extent to which the judge has come down to the Air Force.
If you said we should exercise judicial restraint, we've either got jurisdiction or we don't. I don't know how, if we have jurisdiction, we restrain ourselves from exercising it.
Could you please compare and contrast CCR to this case and then reach a conclusion as to whether there's jurisdiction or not and why?
Yes, Your Honor. Chief Judge Baker, within that regard, Center for Constitutional Rights is directly on point, and what Center for Constitutional Rights did was looked at a number of jurisdictional cases there. I believe the one that's most on point is ABC Incorporated versus Powell. And of all the cases that this court looked at, it was concerned what was the accused's role in that proceeding. And that's why in ABC Corporate versus Powell, it said the accused joined to vindicate his right to find that there was jurisdiction here. I believe CCR is directly on point here, such that there isn't jurisdiction, principally because A1CLRM is a non-party.
Now, you're not doing a compare and contrast. You're doing, here's my conclusion and why. What would be the strongest argument as to why there is jurisdiction, and how would you rebut it?
Your Honor, I believe the strongest argument, which I wouldn't agree with, is that this case is more closely to Hassan in that regard, that it has a potential to impact the findings and sentence. But my rebuttal to that, Your Honor, would be Hassan dealt specifically with, one, an accused bringing that particular case, and two, about the impartiality of the military judge. Here, whether or not someone else can make an argument to a military judge and advocate is not going to have an impact on that judge who is presumed to know and follow the law.
Counsel, let me ask you this question. Do you disagree? Well, I mean, I think that you disagree. Can you explain to me why you disagree that if in fact, and I'm not saying that you do, but if in fact, I don't know what we're calling her, the appellant, the appellee, whoever the victim is, right? If she in fact has the right to make arguments, to attempt to influence, right, to influence what evidence is or is not admitted at court martial, how does that decision not impact the findings and sentence? And so, isn't that a threshold question one that we have to determine in order to determine whether we have jurisdiction? You see what I'm saying? If she doesn't have a right to make to do that, if she doesn't have a right to do anything more than weigh in on the things that 412 specifically describes, then that's not impacting the evidence that's admitted, right? But if she does, how does that not impact potentially the findings and sentence of the court martial?
Well, Your Honor, understanding that your question assumes that there is a right to be heard versus a reasonable opportunity to be heard. Yeah. The position we would take is that the military judge is still going to hold that hearing. The military judge is still going to evaluate it under 412 or 513 and come to the correct conclusion whether or not that evidence should be admitted or not be admitted.
So that if you have a situation, for example, under 513, in which neither party opposes the admission of the evidence, who then represents the interest of the privilege holder?
Well, Your Honor, in that regard, one, there's still going to be a hearing. And two, what the rule prescribes is that the alleged victim has the reasonable opportunity or the reasonable opportunity to be heard. So
did the military judge err when he said that she doesn't have the right to be heard on the issue of admissibility?
I don't believe that's specifically what he said. He has acknowledged she has, as the rule says, a reasonable opportunity to be heard and how that can happen, whether it's her personally or through trial counsel or in certain circumstances which don't apply through someone else.
So that his statement that she doesn't have a right to issue a legal argument for exclusion of the evidence before a court martial is just musing on his part and it's not part of his order, that in your view then he's not going to order her if she stands up in this court martial and no other person will make the argument for privilege under 513 and she says, I have a right to a privilege and she cites legal authority, you're assuring us that the military judge won't say to her, hey, I told you not to say that?
Your Honor, I can't assure that and that goes to...
Well, why don't we issue an order and tell him he can't do it?
Well, Your Honor, I believe the question really there is, we know what the military judge has said in terms of that he will grant her the reasonable opportunity to be heard as prescribed by the particular rule and nothing more. But that hasn't happened, so we can't speak specifically to what the military.
So, in your view, what he said about her not being able to make legal argument is not part of his order. It was simply background to his decision as to what he would or would not order in this case.
I believe that probably indicates how the military judge would view it, but we're not there, obviously, and we don't know specifically what he would or wouldn't permit it as he's sitting there. And certainly this military judge has taken on, beyond looking at the rules, just as a matter of discretion, whether he would permit a counsel. So
I'm not talking about counsel. I'm talking about the right of LRM to assert her privilege under Rule 513. Can you cite us to any case in military or civilian authority that would preclude a person from citing the legal basis for their assertion of privilege in a court-martial or a federal court or a state court?
I can't cite such a case.
Counsel, is there any 513 evidence at issue in this case?
Not at this time, Your Honor, because we're dealing with MRE 412.
That's not a rule of privilege, is it?
I agree with that.
In your view, does the military judge's ruling at this stage preclude written submissions by counsel on behalf of LRM?
Yes, Your Honor. I believe his ruling at this time would preclude written submissions from the counsel at this time.
Is this ripe for decision?
Let me continue with my question. Is a reasonable opportunity to be heard include submission in writing, or is it your view that a reasonable opportunity to be heard is orally only?
Your Honor, appellee's view that it would include in writing as well, and that it would not be limited to orally, and that is the practice of court martials.
But the document has to be drafted and written solely by the victim, in your view?
In accordance with the military judge's order in this case, yes, I would agree with that, Your Honor.
And that's because you're here representing the military judge's order?
I am, yes, Your Honor.
So is it your view on the facts of this case that the defense has not made a motion here with respect to Rule 513?
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
Is 513 at issue in this case or not?
I don't believe it's an issue yet because they haven't reached that stage of the court-martial.
Has the defense submitted a motion to have evidence admitted under Rule 513?
Your Honor, I apologize. I'll have to check the record to verify whether the defense has, in fact, submitted a motion at this time regarding MRE 513. They were only dealing with 412 at the time the military judge made this ruling.
Is this case ripe?
Your Honor, I believe the real party in interest makes a very good argument dealing with ripeness in its brief to this court. What I would note is from the position of the appellee, obviously, when he concluded his rulings, he noted that there would be an opportunity for the alleged victim to take up a writ of mandamus. So I don't necessarily know it's appropriate for me to stand up and argue on the ripeness grounds with that regard, but I believe the real party in interest position is well received. If this court needs to even reach that level, I believe that the appellee believes that the jurisdiction part is enough to conclude this case.
Assuming jurisdiction, how does one get standing in a court-martial?
We would, Your Honor, for appellee's purposes, we look at standing, we look at the RCMs and the definition of party, and that's what...
Only a party has standing.
Correct. And that's specifically what the military judge rules, that a third party intervener does not have standing. And I don't believe you need to look much past RCM 103.16, which is the definition of parties, and all of the other cases which appellant and the government cite to deals with parties, and parties specifically include trial counsel, defense counsel. So the attempts on their part to say to be heard means that would include any counsel. I would disagree because the RCM 103.16 is...
Counsel, you keep using, I don't mean just you, I mean the world, this world and this particular hearing proceeding appear to use third party and intervener as though they're the same thing. Is that your position? Because my understanding is that all interveners might be third party, but not all third parties are interveners.
Your Honor, I wouldn't necessarily use them interchangeably. It's the same. It's along the lines, Your Honor, of whether or not agency LRM is a stranger to the court. The important point is what positions are they perhaps taking up? And what's clear, the appellant concedes, everyone concedes that agency LRM is not part.
Are you familiar with Federal Rule of Civil Procedure 24, the intervention rule?
Not since law school, Your
Honor. May I make sure I understand your position about standing or jurisdiction, and we may be conflating the two or not. If you take a continuum and you place CCR on one end of the continuum and you place the defendant on another and the government. Is it your view that where does the alleged victim must be afforded a reasonable opportunity to attend and be heard stand on that? Or is it just that everybody to the other side of the defendant and the government is not a party and therefore will never have jurisdiction or standing?
That would be your last statement in that question, Your Honor, would be the appellee's position, which is there wouldn't be, unless you were a party, there wouldn't be jurisdiction.
Just, there's no way to get there from here. 412 could say, under all conditions and absolutely every day of the week, the alleged victim shall be heard. But as long as they're not a party in the sense that they're the defendant or the government, it doesn't matter what the judge does.
Your Honor, as the military justice system is currently constructed, I would agree with you that
I'm not. It's a question in the form of a statement, not the other way around.
Yes, Your Honor. I would agree that there is potentially a way to get to that type of standing. Certainly, Congress could take actions in amending the UCMJ, or the President could perhaps make some changes to the MCM. But as it is currently written, I would state that the appellant. Or an alleged victim would not be able to obtain the jurisdiction which they seek.
Counsel, in your opinion, could either the government or the defense have appealed this ruling of the military judge under Article 62 or otherwise on an interlocutory basis?
I'll first, Your Honor, deal with the government. I don't believe so because Article 62 specifically lays out the times which it could appeal. There hasn't been, for instance, what would apply here, a denial of or an exclusion of evidence. They haven't reached that stage. I believe that A1C Daniel would have jurisdiction to appeal a decision, just as in Hassan, because it goes to the partiality or fundamental fairness of this trial, which hasn't obviously occurred here, but the appellant or the government sits in a much better position jurisdictionally to seek relief than the appellant does in this case, A1C Elder.
Are you aware of any situation where the judge advocate general of the Air Force or any other service has used certification to appeal an interlocutory ruling that the government couldn't have appealed? I've just never seen a case in this posture before, and I'm wondering whether in your view there's any precedent supporting that action.
Your Honor, I'm not aware of precedent for that action. Of course, I was confused at the beginning of how I would be appointed to represent the military judge, and I cite a number of cases where it's the government who takes that up position. So it is unprecedented, I believe, in a number of circumstances. But specifically to your question, no, I'm not aware of case law.
I mean, are we reviewing a case here, or are we reviewing an interlocutory decision on a motion?
It's a judge's ruling, which was viewed by the Air Force Court, which issued an order and not an opinion. So that's, I believe, what the court is reviewing here. And I believe the court only needs to address issue one that has been certified to it, and issues two and three will be mooted if this court finds there's no jurisdiction.
Counsel, I'd ask you to take a look at page 81 of the joint appendix, where it refers to defense motions to admit evidence under MRE 412 and MRE 513. That's the government's response. Is that incorrect? And it refers to defense motions to admit evidence under MRE 513?
No, that's not. That is what it says. Absent any other questions, Your Honor, may I briefly conclude?
Briefly, please.
As the Center for Constitutional Rights, this honorable court should find no jurisdiction and affirm the Air Force Court's order finding no jurisdiction to hear a non-party writ petition. Even if the Air Force Court's order was incorrect in the absence of clear statutory language or case law, the military judge correctly ruled no right existed for an alleged victim to be heard through a third-party counsel. Finally, the drastic instrument of a writ of mandamus is unwarranted in this ordinary case where there's been no judicial usurpation of power and no characteristic of an erroneous practice which is likely to recur. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. We'll now hear from the real party in interest.
Good
Chief Judge Baker, and may it please the court. The real party in interest agrees with the lower court that there was no jurisdiction to issue the writ of mandamus that was requested. But even if there were, the writ of mandamus still would not be available because the appellant has not and cannot meet the strict requirements for issuance of a writ of mandamus. The analysis about whether to issue the writ is fundamentally about separation of powers. The appellant seeks to create a new, previously unknown right. And if that right is going to be created, it must be created by the policymaking branches of government, the president through a change to the MREs, or Congress through a change to the UCMJ.
What right are you saying they're asserting?
Your Honor, they're asserting a previously unknown right for a witness and a court-martial to address the court-martial through counsel. And it is not the proper role of the judiciary to create such a right, and it is certainly not the proper role of the judiciary to create such a right through the prerogative writ of mandamus.
You mentioned this as an unknown right. Where does the Carlson case fit in that context?
Your Honor, the Carlson case did not purport to establish a right. Also, beyond that, Your Honor, I said a right of the complaining witness. It's not clear from the summary disposition that either Carlson or Ryan Jones was a complaining witness in that case, Your Honor. It would be consistent with everything in that summary disposition for them to have been EEO record holders about someone else. So this points out to the...
Right, but it did establish in that case, whether you want to call it a precedent or a mere example, that a person who was not a party to the court-martial could have counsel make a presentation to the military judge on the issue of privilege or exclusion.
Yes, Your Honor, and under 801, under RCM 801, the military judge has discretion to run the courtroom. So it's certainly possible that in cases a military judge will allow a non-party to have counsel.
So in this case, one of the things that the military judge said was that if there was not an alignment of interests in this case, as he viewed it, this might be a different case. Does the military judge in this case continue to have discretion upon a motion by LRM at some point in this proceeding to appoint counsel?
I don't believe he has discretion to appoint counsel, Your Honor. I believe
to recognize counsel.
Yes, Your Honor, certainly.
And so that discretion exists in this case, and that the order that the military judge issued does not preclude LRM from requesting the opportunity to have counsel make a presentation at some point in this case.
It certainly doesn't, Your Honor, and that goes once again to the point that this isn't right. And if you look at page 103 of the joint appendix, the Special Victims Counsel actually says that his client's interests are aligned with the government, and he doesn't expect to argue. And he made that same point again, joint appendix at 149. And so this case has been presented to the trial judge as an instance where the SVC himself is saying that he thinks there's an alignment.
Was that the SVC's final words, or did he later request the opportunity in the event that he would need to make a presentation?
Your Honor, in the reconsideration motion, the SVC requested the opportunity to revisit the issue, if you will, but never actually requested the opportunity to address the court-martial. So again, there has been no harm to A1CLRM's rights, and so there's nothing to redress at this point. The issue isn't right.
So the military judge in this case could, for example, rely on Winthrop, not only for the proposition that constitutional rights apply in courts-martial, but for the point that he made on page 167, that counsel may make a presentation for parties other than the accused.
And of course, Your Honor, the military judge in this case is Winthrop's biographer.
So he could rely on that in the exercise of discretion.
Again, Your Honor, we think that he can rely on 801 to run his courtroom. But the issue is, has the appellant met the requirements to get an order from this court, an extraordinary order from this court, a prerogative writ?
Right. Can I just ask before you get on to that, because I think that's going to flow. is it clear then that, in your view, a reasonable opportunity to be heard could include the opportunity to be heard by counsel?
And, Your Honor, that's the central point here. And this court cannot interpret the words...
I was just wondering what the answer to that question
is. No. The answer is no, Your Honor. This court cannot interpret the words opportunity to be heard to be opportunity to be heard through counsel without revamping the military justice system. To read it in that way would force a massive redistribution of the military's legal resources.
I'm confused. I thought you'd said something else to Senior Judge Efron.
No, Your Honor. There was no inconsistency, Your Honor. I was saying that under 801, the judge can run the courtroom and exercise discretion.
But he does not have the discretion to allow the victim to be heard through counsel.
No, Your Honor, I'm saying that the complaining witness does not have a right under 412, under 513, or under 514 to address
the problem. I'm not asking if there's a right. I'm asking, does 412 permit, does it not require, but permit the victim to be heard through counsel?
And I'd say it's silent on that issue, Your Honor. But
right, I'm asking you what the answer to the question is, though. In your view, if you were sitting up here and standing down there, would you interpret 412 to permit, not require, but permit the victim to be heard through counsel?
And again, Your Honor,
in writing or orally?
And my answer to that question would be 412 does not address that issue. 513 does not address that issue. 514 does not address that issue.
And therefore, the conclusion you would draw would be what?
Look elsewhere, like 801.
Okay. Under 801, would the judge have discretion to permit the victim to be heard through counsel?
And it appears the answer to that question is yes, and Your Honor...
Okay, one more question.
Yes, certainly, Your Honor.
Therefore, would a ruling, if it were to occur, precluding in advance any representation by counsel, orally or in writing, would that be an abuse of discretion?
Certainly not, Your Honor. In fact, Judge Kastenberg below said, if I can authorize this special victim's counsel to participate in the proceeding, I exercise my discretion not to. And, of course, that was based in part on what the special victim's counsel himself had already said to Judge Kastenberg.
I'm trying to avoid the facts of this case. If I were to hold a court-martial and I announced in advance before hearing anybody that under no condition would I hear from counsel under 412 or 801, would that be an abuse of discretion?
No, Your Honor. That would be an exercise of discretion, just like some military judges say, under no instance will a trial counsel or defense counsel ask voir dire questions. You'll do it through me, and other judges let them. The judges have discretion to run their courtroom, Your Honor. But Chief Judge Baker, I'd like to get into this central point about whether...
Before we leave that, does that then mean that if either party has called a witness and the witness asserts a privilege under Rule 513 and the witness states that the issue is complicated and wishes to have the presentation made by counsel, and the judge says, as a matter of law, I cannot grant you that representation by counsel, would that be subject to a writ that this court could then grant if the judge said, as a matter of law, my hands are tied and I can't do it?
And our answer to that, Your Honor, is no. But it's no because that individual, that non-party, the CCA wouldn't have jurisdiction to issue a writ to that non-party. The All Writs Act is not a jurisdiction-granted statute. That non-party can never become an appellant at the Air Force Court of Criminal Appeals. Therefore, to issue a writ for that individual would not be in aid of the Air Force Court's jurisdiction, because it would never have jurisdiction over an appeal by the non-party. It would be an expansion, and Clinton versus Goldsmith expressly prohibits that.
Well, Clinton against Goldsmith was a case that involved an administrative proceeding. The Court of Criminal Appeals here described this proceeding as a civil administrative proceeding. Who is the subject of a civil administrative proceeding in the case that's now before us?
Well, Your Honor, in this instance, we have a suit by a service member, A1CLRM, against Judge Kastenberg. So they are the individuals involved in this litigation, Your Honor.
So what civil administrative action is being requested in this case.
But, well, Your Honor, it's the equivalent of APA review. You know, what we really have here, there may be a remedy in this instance where A1C LRM's rights are denied, but that remedy would be in U.S. District Court. And so,
if the judge said, I'm not gonna hear you.
Exactly.
513.
Exactly.
Court martial can't, in the court, the judge said that in your view, the Court of Criminal Appeals couldn't do anything about that, that it's up to the U.S. District Courts to run the military justice system at that point.
Well, not to run the military justice system, Your Honor, but in that instance, because there would be no jurisdiction at the CCA, there would be the opportunity to go into U.S. District Court in a civil proceeding. And what the Air Force Court, I think, correctly identified was that the petition for extraordinary relief filed there was the substitute for what should have been, if there was any action at all, a civil proceeding in U.S. District Court.
What is she, if she went into U.S. District Court, what's she asking for?
Well, Your Honor, I was addressing a hypothetical with Judge Efron where the military judge...
Could a district court mandamus a military judge?
Certainly, Your Honor.
Okay.
And so we were addressing a hypothetical where the judge said, I'm not going to hear from you. You know, not this case at all. I mean, the military judge in this case expressly noted that he would give her an opportunity to be heard. But we were addressing a hypothetical where there was a clear violation of 412. In that instance, where's the remedy? And the remedy in that instance would lie in U.S.
So that's the relationship that Congress set up in Article 66, 67 in the All Writs Act, that if the military judge takes an action to deny a person a right that is provided to that person under the Manual for Courts Martial of the UCMJ, if that person is not a party, then it's up to the U.S. District Courts to decide what will take place in the court-martial.
Your Honor, that's a consequence of the strict limitations that Congress placed on the jurisdiction under Article 66 and 67. And as statutes establishing jurisdiction for Article I courts, those statutes are to be strictly construed. So it's not that Congress set out to say, gee, we're going to funnel these into U.S. District Court. You know, that's just a function. Our system interacts with U.S. District Courts in odd ways. You know, our habeas things are brought under 2241, which is usually a conditions of confinement habeas statute, because Congress didn't really mesh them. This court had to, I know Your Honor is the main historian on the Dubé hearing. You know, this court had to recognize the Dubé hearing at the government's request in the Dubé case, because Congress hadn't set up the equivalent of a 2255. So, you know, there are holes in the system. And so it's not that Congress necessarily intended to say, okay, your remedy lies in U.S. District Court. That's just a consequence of the way that the system
so
is set up.
Did this court err in filling that hole in Dubé?
Oh, no, Your Honor. And, of course, that's not an issue in this case at all. I'm just trying to point out that sometimes there are gaps. And so it's not necessarily that Congress intended there to be a gap, but sometimes there are gaps. And it's for Congress to fill that gap. It's not for the judiciary to do so.
Counsel, can you answer my question? Answer the question that I asked before about the nature of the proceeding here. What we have before us is not a writ of mandamus by the victim, correct?
Correct.
We have three certified issues from the TDAG. Are you aware of any other instance in which an interlocutory decision on a motion by a military judge has been certified?
Judge Ryan, I was thinking about that when you asked the question. I couldn't think of one, but it's a very interesting question, and
I guess my question is, how is this here? I mean, it's not a case. It's a decision on a particular motion. It's not a matter that the government or the appellant could have sought by right an interlocutory appeal on.
That's right, Your Honor.
I'm just wondering how it's here at all.
And it is here by certification, and certainly the real party in interest would have no objection if this court were to hold that it has no jurisdiction to review the lower court's decision. But if I may, Your Honor, I'd like to get into this one crucial point about what would happen if the phrase opportunity to be heard in 513 and 514 were construed to read opportunity to be heard through counsel. And if the phrase were read in that manner, then the United States government would be obligated to provide counsel at its expense to every 513 or 514 claimant who is required to be at the court martial.
Why is that the case? Has the Supreme Court held that the opportunity to be heard requires the appointment of government counsel
no,
for a non-party?
No, Your Honor, it's because of the language of 513 and 514. So if we read that phrase through counsel, this is what 513 would say, Your Honor. The patient shall be afforded a reasonable opportunity to attend the hearing and to be heard through counsel at the patient's own expense unless the patient has been otherwise subpoenaed or ordered to appear at the hearing. So if this court, I'm sorry, Your Honor, I see my time has expired. If I could have leave to complete that answer.
Of course.
Thank you, Your Honor. So if this court were to read the phrase opportunity to be heard to mean opportunity to be heard through counsel, then the rest of that rule, and same with 514, but for victim instead of patient, would require the United States government to appoint counsel for that individual if the individual was either subpoenaed to attend the trial or ordered to attend the trial, which of course is the norm, which would mean that reading that phrase through counsel into the phrase to be heard, as the appellant urges and as the Air Force Appellate Government Division urges, would essentially require every service to establish a special victims counsel unit and would even require an expansion of the Air Force's special victims program to represent both non-legal assistance authorized recipients and to represent victims in non-sex abuse cases if that person is a patient in a 513 hearing or a victim in a 514 hearing. And that, it goes back to Spann and what this court said about not engrafting these new rules through judicial ruling, but through what this court appropriately called the deliberative process of changes to the MCM and the UCMJ.
Counsel, with respect to my question earlier of other counsel, in this case, has the defense filed a motion to admit evidence under Rule 513?
Yes, sir.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You're welcome. The court will now hear from the United States.
Chief Judge Baker, honorable members of this court, I'm Major Tyson Kindness with Colonel Don Christensen, and together we represent the United States. The United States maintains a strong interest in ensuring that the rights afforded to the accused, the government, and the victim throughout the court-martial process are fairly applied and enforced to preserve the rule of law and maintain the integrity.
How is this like CCR or not? You've heard the various arguments. What are your arguments? And you dance around this in the brief because you want to preserve both sides of the argument for the future. What is your argument today as to whether there is jurisdiction based on CCR?
The government firmly believes that jurisdiction has attached here in a consistent reading with CCR, and we're mostly aligned with LRM's counsel in this respect, in that there is a regulatory right under 412 and 513 that establishes jurisdiction. It bestows the right upon LRM. Second, unlike CCR, where you have a civil matter, parties that are complete, non-parties that are complete strangers to the action, here you actually have a witness whose evidence, this substantive evidence, is so critical to the case that it could affect the findings, particularly the findings of the case, but potentially the sentence as well. And LRM in this case, unlike CCR, isn't trying to assert a civil administrative claim. She is, under the rules of evidence, someone who has been given a right, whether we want to call it a limited right to intervention. That is how she is how CCR, this court provides you jurisdiction.
Jumping from jurisdiction to standing, does that limited right give her standing?
Yes, Your Honor.
How?
We believe it's very similar to how a non-party could assert their interest once they've been subpoenaed, such as the Woodridge cases. RCN 703, specifically E2F, the President himself has authorized that a non-party who has received a subpoena can then, for a very limited purposes, enter into the courtroom and advocate their interest, especially if they believe that the interest in those documents or that testimony is overly burdensome or oppressive. In a very similar analysis here, the President, through Military Rule of Evidence 412 and 513, has given the victim limited standing under these circumstances to be heard.
To what extent? To how far does that extend? Does it extend to motion practice?
We do believe that she has the right to make.
Does she have the right to appointed counsel at government expense?
No, Your Honor. It just so happens in the Air Force we have established a program.
Right.
Well,
right.
Could you address if you maybe get that part in? Would you address then the argument of the counsel for the accused in this case, who looked at the rule and said this is going to require appointment at government expense? Is there a way, in your view, to interpret the rule that would not require appointment at government expense?
Do 412 and 513 apply in the same manner as in an addendum?
I believe so, Your Honor. I don't think that the government is going to be required to provide counsel. I mean, this right has existed for a number of years now. We are saying that the right has been misapplied in this instance, but it doesn't mean that the government has to appoint an attorney for the victim.
It's simply a 412.
513, though. You're in 412 right now.
Yes, sir.
And Judge Efron's question, which followed from the dialogue with with the accused counsel, was what about the language in 513 that says unless the patient has been otherwise subpoenaed or ordered to appear at the hearing, they pay for their counsel at their own expense unless the patient has been subpoenaed. And the question for you is, are 412 and 513 to be applied in the same manner, and how is 513 distinct, and does 513 lead to the result of having to pay for counsel and so on?
That is a key distinction, Your Honor, and under the language of 513, it does appear under those limited circumstances that the government may be obligated to provide counsel to the victim in that case.
Okay.
Or would be the victim in that scenario.
Say in patient victim.
Yes, sir.
Okay, but in the context of 412, what you're saying, I think, is that the fortuity that the Judge Advocate General of the Air Force, not Secretary, because it's not a service regulation, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
Chose to establish this program is the only thing that gives her counsel.
Or she could, at this point, yes, or she could have hired civilian counsel as well.
Well, of course, she's a member of the Armed Forces, so she's entitled to legal assistance under 1044 and 1565B kind of shades into that. But legal assistance has never been recognized to encompass representation at courts-martial, right?
Not until now, Your Honor.
Wait, are we saying that legal assistance under 1044 comprehends representation at courts-martial?
No, we're saying that the SVC program has been established through the statutes that Congress has passed for the league. So for the legal assistance.
Oh, wait a minute. Now you're really losing me. Are you saying that the SVC program is a legal assistance program?
Yes, Your Honor. I mean, that's where
it's a legal assistance program. Okay.
Program,
well, then, which way does that cut?
Do we have to decide anything about SVC
in
this case? This is a 412 case, is it not?
Yes, absolutely, Your Honor. The SVC program is a collateral issue that's really not before this court. What's before this court is, does LRM have the right to be heard through counsel? And the government's position is that she does have a right to be heard.
Assuming jurisdiction and standing.
Assuming jurisdiction and standing. She has the right to be heard through counsel. But it's only a limited right that is founded in the rules of evidence. The government does not believe that it is a constitutional right, nor is it through the CVRA as been advocated by LRM's counsel.
Okay, well, could you just answer my question? Does legal assistance, as traditionally understood, comprehend a right to be represented court-martial?
As traditionally understood, no, Your Honor.
No, it's civil, is it not?
It is, but Congress in its lawmaking authority can provide that.
But they haven't done that, have they? Read 1044 and read 15. Those are legal assistance statutes, right?
Yes, but the newest edition of the legal assistance statute says that counsel can be appointed to represent the victims.
Right. Within the limits of the legal assistance program.
Right, and in this matter, the legal assistance issue that has arisen is her right to privacy. And the Judge Advocate General of the Air Force has provided her representation.
Okay, I'll let you go because
You said that in your view under 412 there's a right to be heard that it encompasses a right to be heard through counsel.
Yes,
right?
Your Honor.
Is that, what are the contours of that right in your view?
You think the contours of the right are the right to be heard orally or in writing through counsel during the 412 or the 513 hearing, but that right does not provide a right to appeal the correctness of the military judge's ruling.
Okay. So in your view, it's an absolute right?
It's an absolute right until it is changed by the president.
What if the judge were, in his or her discretion, to determine that it was not reasonable under the circumstances presented?
So it's not an absolute right in those terms, Your Honor, because the government fully understands that the judge can control his courtroom. And we don't think it would be an abuse of discretion at all. If an SVC came into the courtroom and the military judge said, we have pleadings from the defense, we have pleadings from the government. Counsel, can you explain to me what you would argue differently? Is there something new that you want to offer? Is there a different argument that you want to make? And if the counsel says, absolutely not, I am fully aligned with the trial counsel in this matter, I think it would be within the judge's broad discretion to say, okay, well, in a manner, for a matter of efficiency and judicial economy, we're going to proceed unless you can present something new to this court. I think that would clearly be.
Well, are you saying you agree with the accused, basically, that's an 801 issue? And it's not an abuse of discretion for the judge in his discretion to deny it.
It can be an 801 issue, but here the difference is that the judge flatly denied LRM her right to counsel. So if the judge gives the right, then it's not an abuse of discretion. But or if he gives the right, then it's not an abuse of discretion. But and especially if once we're in trial, if there's nothing new to offer, well, I think the judge...
Okay, now what... But let's back up. What establishes this right to counsel?
The right to counsel would...
The absolute right.
The absolute right, because you're saying it's an abuse of discretion to deny it.
Yes,
right?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay. What establishes the right which it makes an abuse of discretion to deny it?
Well, the rule that we're saying that if she has counsel, whether it's civilian, take this outside of the context of the SVC.
What does 412 say?
She has the reasonable opportunity to be heard. And
okay.
She has,
does that establish a right to be heard through counsel?
Yes, Your Honor. The
How?
I believe so. The right to be heard through counsel exists within the right because we have other contexts within the MCM. So in a number of places that have been cited in the government's brief, they've been cited in LRM's brief, where the president has decidedly chose to use the term the right to be heard. In all of those contexts, the right to be heard means the right to be heard through counsel. And not only to
period, without any distinction for whether it's reasonable in the circumstance presented.
Right. And
that's what we're trying to focus on. Are you saying it's an absolute right, or is it a right modified by reasonable opportunity?
It's a right... it's an absolute right to be heard, because here what we bring it back to is she has been denied the right to be heard, flatly denied. She has the right to be heard, but the judge can limit.
But just to be clear, you read the words in 412, reasonable opportunity to be heard, to mean reasonable opportunity to be heard through counsel.
Yes, Your Honor.
And any modification to that has to come from something else.
A modification, you mean an express limitation by the president that says it does not encompass the right to be heard?
No, I'm just saying you're saying it's an absolute right, so I'm asking you if it's an absolute right contained within 412 itself, on what authority do you change the absolute right, and how logically do you say she has the absolute right to be heard through counsel under 412, but if what the military judge decides in the 412 ruling is not to her liking, she doesn't have a right to appeal it?
Because he's satisfied, and I think that's a good point, Your Honor, because at this point, she has the right to be heard within that context before the ruling, but we do believe it would be a separation of powers issue, and it would have to either be the president or a legislative body like Congress to then provide a right to appeal, and that's something where you can look to the CVRA.
Well, how is it a meaningful right if you don't have any opportunity to vindicate it, the right being improperly... adjudicated.
Right. It comes down to the question of having a right and then the enforceability of that right. And that's one of the issues that has arisen in the civilian context out of the CVRA, which is one of the important amendments that was made in 2004 when the CVRA was passed. It was a new statute where it gave the express right of a writ of mandamus when the right had been denied in the federal court system. And it was to make very clear...
But you don't disagree, talking about the CVRA, you don't disagree that the right there doesn't extend to pretrial motions, right?
Absolutely, Your Honor. Yes, Your Honor.
It applies to decisions to accept a plea, sentencing issues, parole issues.
Yes, sir.
Right? Not this context.
Exactly. And the government isn't advocating that the CVRA is applicable here. We're just using that statute as an analogy to...
I'm using it,
ma'am, as an example to show... If we want to extend the right to appeal to LRM, it would take some type of lawmaking body to do that. The CVRA is an example because it expressly, an important part of that statute is not only the rights that are contained in subsection A, but more importantly, the enforceability procedures that are...
So in your view, she didn't have the right to appeal to the Court of Criminal Appeals in this case?
No, and here's the key distinction, Your Honor. She wouldn't have the right to appeal to the Court of Criminal Appeals challenging the correctness of the military judge's ruling if we had reached that stage. What she has done now is raise a question of law as to what the right that she receives under 412, what that right means. And that's why the government believes she has the opportunity to be here. She has raised a question of law to the CCA regarding an interpretation of a military rule of evidence.
She hasn't raised anything here, though. The judge advocate general has raised something here.
Yes,
she's raised nothing here.
Yes, ma'am. And that's an interesting point that we did raise in our brief. The government does understand that under an All Writs Act, extraordinary writ under the All Writs Act, this court can maintain original jurisdiction. But an interesting twist in this case is that it was before the CCA as an extraordinary writ and was presented to this court through a TJAC certification.
Doesn't our case law permit recharacterization of a writ appeal into a original writ?
Yes, Your Honor, we do.
So is there anything that would preclude us from recharacterizing a certification into a writ?
No, and that's what I was going to follow up with, Your Honor.
So if that's the case, why can't we decide the case here? What do we have to send it back to the CCA for?
Well, as a prudential matter, the government believes that it's best before the CCA because they did not... One, CCA has fact-finding authority.
What fact-finding authority do they have on a writ involves solely an issue of law, as you just previously described it?
Correct, Your Honor. And that wouldn't be the key component here. But what's more important is that, as a prudential matter, sending it back to the CCA would be give the CCA an opportunity to decide the question of law, which is commonly done. It's very rare, although this court has the authority to do so, it's very rare that it skips the CCA and doesn't allow them to decide the
Counsel, this case was certified to, may I? This case was certified to us by the Judge Advocate General. The government has urged us to hold that there's a right to counsel under 412 and 513. Your brief on page 23 specifically notes that this issue has been marked by presidential inaction. Now, this is a matter that the president can resolve with a stroke of the pen. Why is the government asking this court through litigation to solve this problem when the executive branch has all the power it needs under Article 36 to solve it by itself?
Because we believe that under MRE 412 and 513 that the right currently exists and that this court can interpret what the right to reasonably be heard means. But if this court does not do so, we will be left with the executive action or congressional action. And as I see, my time has expired, Chief Judge Baker. Pending no further questions.
There are no further questions. We thank you for your argument. And we will now hear from the appellant for rebuttal and have good luck rebutting all the arguments.
Thank you, Your Honor. Judge Ryan, I want to respond to your questions regarding 412. I sent you in a supplemental citation to authority we provided United States versus Stamper, United States versus Saunders, and the McDaniel case from the Fourth Circuit.
Those are the unpublished opinions from the Fourth Circuit?
Your Honor, Stamper and Saunders are not unpublished. The McDaniels case is unpublished.
Right, but the other two published cases are citing to the unpublished case, correct?
They in fact cite to an unpublished case, but in all those cases...
Counsel, in Saunders, did Judge Ellis rely on McDaniel, or did he state cognizant of the rule about relying on unpublished opinions, did he state that his action was consistent with McDaniel's?
That's in fact what he said, that it was consistent with that ruling. Your Honor, Judge Ryan, you also asked about Has there been a 67A2? United States v. Curtin was an example where an Article 62 appeal to the government, the government filed for an extraordinary writ and the TJAG certified it. So that's an example where TJAG has used his certification authority to have this court review.
But was it an extraordinary writ after the Article 62 appeal had been denied?
I believe so, but the case came up as an extraordinary writ to the service.
But the underlying issue was one that was properly before the CCA, right under Article 62?
Yeah, yes, Your Honor. There's a number of cases that I would point. It's not uncommon for a non-party to be provided the opportunity in military courts to be heard through counsel. And I just cite you to Harding, which was a 513 case. And that's a case where the Tenth Circuit and the District Court went back and said that was the proper way to handle it. It was actually to allow them to be heard through counsel in a 513 hearing. Corporations have been heard of the victims in Carlson, the press, ABC, BPAL, advocacy groups in the CCR were had standing at the trial level to be heard through counsel. The Clement case, a wife was allowed to be heard on a 513 issue. And the Supreme Court has allowed lawyers in the Scientology case, for example. So it's not unheard of for a non-party, limited participant to be heard through counsel in courts. In fact, we would suggest it's the norm, and provided they show standing.
Should 412 and 513 be interpreted in the same manner, mutatis mutandis?
Yes, Your Honor. We believe this should be... first of all, I want to say in those cases, they actually went beyond what we're requesting. They actually gave a right. They court-appointed counsel in those cases. We are not suggesting that. We're suggesting in this case, she has counsel. She should be treated no different than all these civilians.
I was asking a separate question from your case citations. Just simply, it's a simple question, which is whatever we say for 412 should be said of 513 as well? Yes,
absolutely,
or no?
Okay.
Do you agree with the government that it's an absolute right under 412? And then 513?
Your Honor, what I'd say is if in the limited circumstances where somebody brings their counsel with them, in other words, they are represented by counsel, they show up.
Every victim, right, that presumably 412 motion would be being brought against the victim, right? I mean, with respect to the victim in the case.
Correct.
Right? You're not going to be bringing 412 motions with respect to people that aren't the victim in the case.
That's correct, Your Honor.
And under the Air Force program, all such victims have counsel.
Your Honor, but that is absolutely correct. That is correct. But what I'm suggesting is that her rights don't emanate from the SVC program.
No, I'm asking you a different question, which is, do you agree with the government that the words in MRE 412, reasonable opportunity to be heard, include the unwritten words by counsel?
Yes, Your Honor. And I would say we go back to Pell v. Alabama, when the Supreme Court talked about it in any case.
I'm asking about 412.
Yes, Your Honor.
Do you agree with that statement by the government?
Yes, Your Honor.
And in your, do you agree also with the statement that the military judge has a discretion under 801 to cut that right off?
Not to cut the right off. There could be, for example, if the judge would not have to delay the hearing. In other words, he could say, you know what, you
so have. If the counsel was late, then he wouldn't have to give him that right. Is that what you mean?
He could put, the reasonable part goes to the notice and opportunity to be heard.
So what if, as in this case, the counsel for the victim says to the military judge, my interests are completely aligned with the government and I don't expect to argue?
Your Honor, in that case, that's a case that happens quite often. There's no requirement. It's the victim's choice. The victim can say, I want to be heard. The prosecution is just
no, but I'm not asking you about victim's choice. I'm asking you under those circumstances, and the counsel is a gunner. He still wants to be heard because he likes to hear himself talk, which is an occupational hazard, right? Can the military judge say, as he could say to any counsel, I don't want to hear from you?
In your hypo, Your Honor, what you're saying is the victim just said she didn't want her.
No.
My counsel has nothing to say.
No. The victim wants him to say. The victim wants him to basically repeat the exact same stuff in different language, in different words, that the government counsel already said. And the military judge says, I don't want to hear it. In the interest of time, in the interest of, in the interest of judicial economy, I'm cutting you off.
Your Honor, judges regularly do that with parties. In other words, if you don't have something different to say, I don't want to hear from you.
No, but before he even says it, all the victim's counsel has said is, as was said in this case, I'm in agreement with the government, and I don't expect that I'm going to argue. Can the military judge, and I'm not saying that this military judge said that, I'm not asking you to concede that, can the military judge say, then I'm not going to hear from you, period?
If the SVC says to the military judge, I have nothing to say, then
no,
the military
that's,
judge...
No, you're changing my hypo. My hypo simply says, I'm in agreement with the government counsel. But I love to hear myself talk, and I have 45 minutes of argument. Can the military judge say, well, too bad, I'm not going to listen to you?
Your Honor, the military judge could say to the SVC, if you have nothing new to add, I don't want to hear from you. You don't have a different argument. I've been told that by many judges.
Okay.
Counsel, yep. Go ahead.
Does the victim, the prosecutrix, have a right to counsel appointed at government expense?
No, Your Honor.
Okay. It's simply the fortuity that the TJAG and the Air Force established this thing.
The same with all the other cases I said where folks right. with legal interests bring their attorney with them.
Yeah, okay. And Powell v. Alabama, of course, involved the right of a party to counsel, did it not?
That is correct, Your Honor.
Thank you.
What about 513? That second section of 513, would that not suggest the right at government expense?
Perhaps it would, Your Honor.
That's your. That's the complete answer.
Yeah. Well, I would say, Your Honor, for Airman LRM, that's not an issue because she, in fact, has counsel.
Counsel, as I understood the argument that was made for counsel representing the views of the military judge, the counsel urged us, or at least in response to a question, indicated that the ruling of the military judge would not preclude LRM from making a further motion at a point in trial where LRM would know, if LRM noted that the interest between LRM and the government diverged and would want representation by counsel at that point. Now, I know you've not read the rule in that fashion, but if we were to read the rule in that fashion, what, if anything, would that change about your argument in this case?
Your Honor, as you state, my view is it was a categorical denial.
I understand that.
That could never happen. If he said you can be heard if you have something different to say, that is essence what he just said.
Yeah, I understand your interpretation of the ruling, but if we were to read the ruling in the manner urged upon us by counsel for the military judge, what, if any, change would that make in your argument?
I think what you're saying, Your Honor, is if the...
It's a ripeness question.
Pardon me?
I think the question is really trying to get you to answer the question, what if this court were to determine it was not ripe?
Your Honor, our position is that because he denied standing, we can never get there. I mean, he cannot now go into court and make any kind of request whatsoever.
Okay, counsel, in terms of what Judge Efron just said, that basically if the military judge were to say, if you later show that the interests diverge, then I'll hear from you. Wouldn't that be consistent with the way that intervention is treated in the civil system? I mean, you don't disagree that it's extraordinary. It's extraordinary to allow someone to intervene or to act as an intervener with the same rights as the parties. Okay? In the criminal system, there's no such rule. Right? And in the civil system, when intervention is permitted, don't they have to show, right, that the interests and rights are ones that are not already being vindicated by another party?
Yes, Your Honor. I think the SVC clarified this in the motion for reconsideration where there were unequivocal demands and then an unequivocal denial from the military judge. And that's why the SVC went back with the motion to reconsider.
Okay, so you're not going to answer my question.
Counsel, do you have any other arguments you'd like to make before the court?
No, Your Honor.
All right. The court thanks counsel for all the various entities. And thank you very much. We thank the audience as well. And we stand in recess until further order of the court.
All rise.
court stands adjourned until further order of the court.